This is Taking Stock on Bloomberg. I'm Pim Fox. My guests are Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News, Peter Coy of Bloomberg Business Week. We have Vivian Salama live in Cairo, Egypt. And I want to bring into the conversation Jonathan Schanzer. He is a former terrorism and finance analyst at the U.S. Department of Treasury. He's currently vice president of research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's also the author of Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine and Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliates Group, and the Next Generation of Terror. Jonathan Schanzer, should Americans be concerned about what they're seeing on their screens and hearing about the unrest and the protests going on in Egypt, or is this containable?
Well, I'm not sure if it's containable. This is, as everyone is saying, including White House spokesman, this is a very fluid situation, but there are obviously some risks associated with this right now. First of all, we don't know the role of the Muslim Brotherhood here. This is a potentially dangerous organization, an organization that has renounced violence, but is connected to a larger Islamist network. If Islamists take control or hijack these protests, we could be in for a very bumpy ride. And then just broadly speaking, if you look at the amount of weaponry we've provided Egypt over the years and the strength of its military, to not know whose hands it's going to go into next, this is yet another concern that we're looking at here in Washington.
Vivian Salama, come in on the military topic. Have you heard anything or read anything about the disposition of military forces?
At this point, what I know is what I'm seeing in the streets. The military has sort of backed down a little bit since the start of the protests a few hours ago. We see them marching alongside of the protesters, but not with them. They're not aligning themselves to anyone at this point. They certainly don't seem to be, greatly supporting the government at this point in the night. Just based on the fact that they're not stopping the protesters, and so that already seems like it may be a shift in what's happening.
Well, Vivian Salama, Jonathan mentioning the Muslim Brotherhood. We know that a number of their leaders were detained today. And to the extent that you can, give us a sense of what their role has been within the protests.
They organize a lot of protests, and they've been doing a lot to sort of rally the troops, if you will. I did speak to Assamin Aryan, who's one of the very senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood, last night, and he was arrested just a few hours after I spoke to him. He was very sure that today would be a big day for the protests, but that was more based on the fact that it's Friday and it's a day off here. Friday tends to be a big protest day where people just come out after Friday prayers, and so they seemed very sure that people would be gathering, but as far as anything exclusively planned, they definitely have been maintaining the same tone all throughout, and that is that we have no specific agenda for the Muslim Brotherhood. We are part of the people of Egypt, and we want to be perceived that way.
Jonathan Schanzer, Egypt, the most populous Arab country, about 87 million people, 17 million of them in Cairo. Should we be concerned about other Arab countries, demonstrations in Yemen, the Tunisian government falling, demonstrations in Algeria? Are we going to see further demonstrations and protests in places such as Jordan?
In short, the answer is yes. I mean, you have to look at what's happened here. The progression, it started in December with some protests in the outlying areas of Tunisia. Protests spread to the capital. And then since the fall of Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia, on January 14th, there has been a sense of empowerment across the Arab world, populations believing that they may be able to replicate what happened in Tunisia. So, yes, we are seeing signs of unrest in Jordan. We're seeing it in Yemen. Some signs of it even in Saudi Arabia, although I think that's largely contained right now. And then obviously Egypt. So there's a sense that they may be able to set off a domino effect. And that is obviously worrisome when you're looking at oil markets, when you're looking at overall stability, and you're looking at the fact that the United States has been in bed and has been largely supporting these autocrats over the last half a century. The populations there have a long memory, and they will remember that the United States was on the wrong side of history. So a lot could go wrong here.
Jonathan Schanzer, if those dominoes start falling, what kind of opportunities does that present for the likes of Al-Qaeda, for terrorist groups?
It depends on the country. In Yemen, for example, I think there is a stronger Islamist presence and a stronger al-Qaeda presence. I'm not going to say here right now that I think that they could take over the government, but they certainly could take over large swaths of ungoverned spaces. The same can be said of Algeria, where al-Qaeda, the Islamic Maghreb, otherwise known as AQIM, could take over some parts of the country. Libya, the same. You have to really look at the ungoverned spaces and the presence of al-Qaeda in each one of these areas. But really what we're looking at is the more organized Islamist groups. I mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They have an offshoot in Jordan called the Islamic Action Front.
We're going to continue our conversation about the events unfolding in Egypt. I want to thank Vivian Salama reporting from Cairo. More on turmoil in the Middle East.
And we're back on Taking Stock on Bloomberg. I'm Dave Wilson, along with Pim Fox. We have Peter Coy from Bloomberg Businessweek, Jim Sterngold from Bloomberg News, and Jonathan Schanzer from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Jonathan, before the break, you were talking about how you have to look country by country to see where terrorists may take advantage of any political turmoil. What country are you most worried about when it comes to that?
I'll tell you two. Yemen, which has always been on the brink and has always been a hotbed for al-Qaeda. Algeria as well. We've seen it overrun by organizations like al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, which I mentioned earlier. But don't forget that Egypt in the 1990s was a hotbed for what was essentially a precursor to al-Qaeda. Islamism is alive and well in that country. And as we watch this turmoil, you have to wonder whether some of these figures are going to resurface again.
How is it possible for the United States to stay out of this?
Well, it's not, and I think that's what I think most Americans are coming to the conclusion of right now. I think that the president tried to sort of stay on the sidelines, did not want to mention any of this during his State of the Union address other than a very vague reference to Tunisia. And now, we saw Vice President Biden come out and actually defend Hosni Mubarak, saying that he's not a dictator, even though the man has been in power for 30 years. I think there's a certain sense now in Washington that this White House is going to have to come out on the right side of history. And these are the statements that we're beginning to see squeak out of the White House right now, that ultimately the future of Egypt is going to be in the hands of the people, that sort of thing. So they're softening the rhetoric and at least giving a nod to the people who are bravely going out and confronting the military state.
Well, beyond those kind of statements, though, I mean, how much can the U.S. really do? I mean, you think about the political will to help these countries, especially after what the U.S. has been through in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, what's possible here?
Well, if you asked me what was possible 5 years ago, I could have told you a lot more. If you remember the Bush Doctrine, which Sarah Palin famously flubbed in an interview, it actually was based on shoring up the prospects of Arab reformers. We have since foregone a number of those programs, and we cut funding to them. But 5 years ago, we were actually maintaining very good ties with a number of democratic organizations that could have worked as stand-ins for a government. They could have actually worked to ensure a democratic transition. I'm not sure how much we have right now on the ground. So essentially what we need to do is continue to call for calm and try to hope and try to help ensure a smoother transition if, in fact, the Mubarak government steps down. Although I have to say right now that, when you look at the history of the Mubarak government, there's a reason why it's been in place for 30 years. It is a military state. It has strength. And I don't foresee him stepping down unless he is absolutely put up against the wall.
Let me ask if you could handicap a little bit. On the one hand, we have someone like Mohammed al-Baradei in the country who's very westernized, technocratic, and more democratic-oriented. On the other hand, you have, as you noted, Islamic groups in the country, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood. If the government were to be overthrown, who do you think would be most likely to end up in power?
Well, you mentioned two, I think, strong candidates. If it's between those two, I would say the Muslim Brotherhood, primarily because they have infrastructure, and al-Baradei does not. You have to remember that he's been out of the country, and he's been sidelined by the political process inside the country. He was actually not allowed to even take place in the elections that happened in the fall of 2010. But also remember that you have a military that's very strong. It was the military that took over in 1952 and 1953. This is a military that ensures stability in the country. And then you have some other, you know, you've got Omar Suleiman, for example, who is the top spy, the head of the Mukhabarat and the Interior Ministry in Egypt. He, I'm sure, is looking at things right now and wondering whether he could take over. But, you know, when you step back and look at really what's going on here, I don't think that the Egyptian people will stop protesting until they begin to see some political reform take place. That's essentially what's been happening in Tunisia. And if they follow that model, and we have every reason to believe that that's the model that the Egyptians are trying to emulate, then I don't think they're going to stop until they really begin to see some reform or until the police put this thing down with live fire and utter brutality.
And do you think Israel should be nervous?
Israel should be nervous for a number of reasons. I mean, number one, the peace agreement that Egypt and Israel share is not one that's ever been on solid ground. The Egyptian people, I've spent some time in Egypt, the Egyptian people still don't like Israel. There's a lot of animosity toward the Israelis, and the average Egyptian feels as if their leaders sold them out when Anwar Sadat flew to Jerusalem and started that process. But the other thing that the Israelis should be worried about is the fact that here in the United States, we've been providing $2.5 billion in aid. It'll be $3 billion this year if, in fact, that continues. And a lot of that aid comes in the form of military assistance. This means that the Egyptians have very sophisticated weaponry. They actually have a larger air force than the Israelis. So
we got to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Jonathan Shanzer, former terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Department of the Treasury.